So I want to thank all the organizers for inviting me to give this talk and to like open this workshop. Today I will talk about supersymmetry in curved spacetime, and I will review some of my work and also some other people's work relating to this subject. So why are we interested in studying supersymmetry in curved space? Well, the reason is that by placing a supersymmetric theory on some manifold, by preserving some supersymmetry, it is then possible to compute exactly many interesting observables. So for instance, one can compute the partition function of the theory on some compact manifold M using localization techniques. Or expectation values of other supersymmetric operators, like, for instance, Wilson loops. And then these exact results can be used to understand the dynamics of the theory of interest, which could be strongly coupled and difficult to access otherwise. So some notable examples are, well, so there has been work initiated by Romas Berger, in computing partition functions for theories defined on S3 times S1. So these are n equal 1 theories with a U1R symmetry for D, which are placed supersymmetrically on S3 times S1. Peston has computed the partition function and expectation values of certain Wilson loop operators on the four spheres for an n equal 2 theory. And another area where a lot of results have been obtained has been that of computing the partition function for n equal 2 theories with a U1R symmetry in three dimensions, which are placed supersymmetrically on the three sphere. So these examples that I've reviewed were like all on manifolds which were very symmetric, like the four sphere, or the round four sphere, or the round three sphere. But it's possible to preserve supersymmetry also on manifolds which are less symmetric. So for instance, we can place various n equal 1, 2, or 4 theories in four dimensions on like cylinders which have as base some squashed three sphere. In the same way, we can consider n equal 2 theories in three dimensions on the squashed three sphere. And there have also been work on placing n equal 2 theories in four dimensions on squashed versions of the round four sphere. And one very interesting thing that happens is that it turns out that the dependence on the geometry, for instance, for these theories placed supersymmetrically on the squashed three sphere, is actually pretty weak. So people have considered different squashing of the three sphere. So there are some which preserve an S2 times U1 isometry. Others just preserve a U1 times U1 isometry. In some of these cases, the metric can depend on arbitrary functions or a finite number of parameters. But in the end, after you compute the partition function on this squash sphere, it turns out that it is just always the same function for a certain theory of a single complex parameter B. So like, it would be nice to understand what this parameter actually is. So this motivates us to like ask several questions. So one question is which manifolds allow for a certain theory to be put supersymmetrically on them. The second is, what is the structure of the resulting theory on the manifold? And finally, how do supersymmetric observables for these theories on this manifold M depend on its geometry? So the outline of the talk. So first of all, I will present a general framework that enables us to understand rigid supersymmetry on curved manifolds in very general terms. Then I will use this framework to classify various supersymmetric backgrounds And they'll also give a survey of results which I've obtained in various number of dimensions, ranging from 2 to 5. And finally, if time allows, I will tell you something about what we can say about the dependence of these partition functions computed on like certain compact manifolds on the geometry of the manifold they're placed on. OK, so first of all, let me specify a little bit better what we mean by rigid supersymmetry on a certain curved manifold. So let's start with a supersymmetric field theory in flat space. So for instance, we could consider an n equal 1 field theory in 4 dimensions. And we would like to place it on some manifold, m, with some metric g, in such a way that like at short distances, like the theory looks like the original n equal 1 theory. but it's modified given the fact that it's placed on this curved space at larger distances. Also, would like the theory to be invariant under some supersymmetry. And given this setup, if I look at this supersymmetry at short distances, this supersymmetry should be part of the flat space superalgebra. So usually, by placing the theory on some curved manifolds, I will lose some of the supercharges. So if I start with a theory which has 4 supercharges in 4D, I could be left with 1 or 2 or like even 4 supercharges. But in general, they will be less than 4. OK, so the idea is to describe, in general, rigid supersymmetry on like a curved space by extending what one usually does to like place a like bosonic field theory on some curved space. Like what one can do is to like couple the theory to gravity and then set the metric to some arbitrary background value and then turn off the fluctuations of the metric fluctuations by sending the Planck mass to infinity. So for a supersymmetric field theory, we can do the same, but instead of coupling the theory to just gravity, we'll couple it to supergravity. And we'll give arbitrary background values to the fields which resides in the gravity multiplet. So the fields are the metric. There are also various auxiliary fields, which depend on the particular supergravity we consider. And also, there is the gravitino. So we'll actually set the gravitino to 0, but keep the metric and the auxiliary fields to be like completely, like we want to give them like completely generic background values. And after we do this, we can send the Planck mass to infinity, keeping the background values for the metric and the auxiliary fields fixed. And by doing so, we'll get some rigid theory. And the algebra of local supersymmetry of the supergravity will generate some rigid supersymmetry whenever the background which I've chosen is invariant under some of the supergravity transformations. So because the variation of the metric and the auxiliary fields are proportional to the gravitino, it's always true that the variation of the metric and the auxiliary fields is 0. So the only thing we have to check is that, oops, the variation of the gravitino itself is 0. And this results in an equation, which I'll call by abuse of diction the Killing-Spinner equation. And that's generically, the form of this equation is like a covariant derivative acting on a spinner is equal to some matrix, which depends on the metric and the auxiliary fields acting on the spinner itself. So in order to find like spaces which preserve some supersymmetry, we need to find spaces where it's possible to find a solution to this equation. OK, so there are some advantages in proceeding this way, instead of like for each manifold trying to construct a supersymmetric theory from scratch. So first of all, different backgrounds are treated in a unified way, because they are interpreted as giving as background values for the supergravity multiplet. Another comment is this is different than linearized supergravity. In linearized supergravity, one looks at small fluctuations around flat space. Here instead, we consider like fixing the supergravity fields to arbitrary background values, which do not need to be close to flat. And also, we'll shut off all the fluctuations of the supergravity fields by sending M Planck to infinity. Also, by looking at this equation, it is apparent that the original matter theory that we coupled to supergravity does not appear here. So the Killing equation only depends on the fields in the gravity multiplets. And therefore, there is a weak dependence on the matter content of the theory that we consider. It's not just that there is no dependence, and I'll explain in the following why I say it's weak. But this allows to treat like different theories in a general way. Are there any questions? Good. So the reason that dependence is weak is that because we do not impose like the equation of motions for the auxiliary fields in the supergravity multiplets, different off-shelf formulations of supergravity lead to different equations, and therefore can lead to distinct deformations, distinct ways of preserving supersymmetry on different manifolds. Therefore, like there is some dependence on the theory insofar different theories can be coupled to different supergravity, different supergravities. So I will review here the situation for n equal 1 theories in 4 dimensions. So it follows from works of Komargoski, Seiberg, and Dumitrescu that an n equal 1 theory in 4 dimensions always possesses what is called an S-multiplet, which contains the energy-momentum tensor as its top component, and it also contains like the supercurrent and other operators. So sometimes, if the theory is like special, this multiplet can be shortened. So for instance, if the theory has a U1R symmetry, then like it allows something which is called the R-multiplet, which is shorter than the S-multiplet. So there is a subset of theories which allow for this multiplet. There is also another supercurrent multiplet, which is like was originally considered by Ferrara and Zumino. So this is the Ferrara-Zumino supermultiplet. It's also shorter than the S-multiplet and different from the R-multiplet. There are some theories which allow both an R-multiplet and an FZ-multiplet. And as a particular example, if the theory is superconformal, then like it allows both multiplet, and actually the multiplet can be shortened even more, so it allows for an even shorter multiplet. So each of these multiplets can be coupled to a different off-shell formulation of supergravity. So for instance, the R multiplet is coupled to what is called the new minimal supergravity in 4 dimensions, which will be like the case that I will consider the most in this talk. The Ferrara-Zumino supermultiplet can be coupled to like the version of supergravity which you read about in Wessenberger. That's the old minimal supergravity. And each of these supergravity will give rise to a certain Killing sphere equations, which can be solved on a certain class of manifolds. So for instance, the new minimal supergravity will give rise to a certain class of supersymmetric manifolds, and the old minimal supergravity to a different class of supersymmetric manifolds. Yes? Yes. Well, I mean, these are just like, so if I take the various supergravities, I can like consider their like their linearized limit. And then in the linearized limit, they couple to the various multiplets. Then there will be clearly like when, if you consider the theory coupled to supergravity at the nonlinear level, then there are like all sorts of Siegel terms that you have to add in order for the theory to be supersymmetric. So those have been worked out in the literature. But yeah, it's not like a trivial problem. So if a theory allows for both the Ferrara-Zumino multiplet and the R multiplet, so for instance, if the theory is a superconformal field theory, then it can actually be placed on a larger set of manifolds, because it can be placed both on the manifolds which allow for the FC matrix, which comes from old minimal supergravity, and from the manifolds which come from new minimal supergravity. On the other hand, if a theory is more generic, so for instance, it only allows an S multiplet, then it can only be placed in the intersection between the two. Because it's a, so the slogan here is that a more special theory can be placed on like a larger amount, larger set of manifolds preserving some supersymmetry. Well, if the theory is more generic, then like the amount, the number of manifolds becomes smaller. Okay, so the example that I will talk mainly about is this new minimal supergravity in four dimensions. So this is the supergravity which couples naturally to theories which have U1R symmetry in four dimensions. So these theories have supercurrent multiplet, which is called the R multiplet, which contains, as I said, the energy momentum tensor. They contain the conserved R current, which corresponds to the U1R. And also, they contain the supercurrent, which generates supersymmetry transformations. The multiplet also contains another operator, which is as the interpretation of a string current. And in total, like all these operators form the R multiplet. And they couple to this new minimal supergravity, whose fields are the metric, which couples to the energy momentum tensor, the gravitino, which will couple to the supercurrent. Then there is a U1R connection, which is an auxiliary field. And finally, there is an auxiliary vector field V nu, which is conserved. So in the rigid limit, we'll set the gravitino to 0, and we'll freeze the metric and the auxiliary fields V nu and A nu to arbitrary background values. And we'll look at trying to solve the Killing-Spinor equation, which comes out of this procedure. Okay, so before doing that, let me just describe a little bit what is the structure of the theory that we'll get out of this. So, like, starting with a theory with a certain Lagrangian L in flat space, I'll get like a Lagrangian, which is a sum of three terms. So L naught is just the flat space theory coupled minimally to the metric. So this is what like you could have guessed, but like clearly, like in general, generic cases, it will not preserve any supersymmetry. In order to preserve supersymmetry, like this theory has to be modified by terms which go like 1 over R, where R is some scale which like just gives you like this overall scale of the manifold. So if I double R, just double all the dimensions. And the terms of order 1 over R just couple the auxiliary fields to certain definite components of the R multiplets. So for instance, we have this A mu, which curly A mu, which came from the string current, which couples to the conserved vector V nu. And also, we have the R current, which couples to the to A mu, which is like the connection for the U1R symmetry. So at this order in the deformation of the flat space theory, we can actually describe this Lagrangian. So we can describe the deformation even if Lagrangian is not available, because it just depends on the operators in the supercurrent. However, like when we go further, like we get also we can get terms of order 1 over R squared, which like are some sort of Siegel terms, and these do depend on like the like theory that I cannot just give an operator definition of these. So, for instance, if I take a chiral field with R charge Q and an anti-chiral field of R charge minus Q. Like there is a term in the Lagrangian which has this form. It's proportional to the R charge. It involves curvature terms and also terms which are bilinear in the auxiliary fields. Okay, so all these terms can be obtained by just taking the rigid limit of like supergravity coupled to matter. So like all the hard work has already been done for us. And in the same way, we can consider the transformation rules, the supergravity transformation rules, and like specialize them to the rigid limit. And we'll get the supersymmetry transformation rules of the resulting theory on the manifold that we have chosen. So these are deformed from like their flat space counterparts because the auxiliary fields appear in various spaces. So for instance, here you see that the R symmetry connections appears as usually it covariantizes all derivatives with respect to the R symmetry. And also, like, there is this vector field V mu, which appears in various places. So when the size of the manifold becomes very large, this A and B are of order 1 over R. So you see that these are deformations of the usual flat space supersymmetry transformation rules. Okay. So the equations that we have to solve in order to see if a manifold allows for supersymmetry are the Skilling-Spinner equations. And for the case of new minimal supergravity, these are written here. So we have an equation. So there are two supergravity variation parameters, Z and Z bar, which like transform under as a right-handed spinner or a left-handed spinner. The left-handed spinner Z has R charge 1. So as you can see here, the covariant derivative is corresponds to like Z having R charge 1. And the right-handed spinner instead of R charge minus 1. One important point in the following is that if we consider theories on Euclidean manifolds, then the spinner Z and the right-hand and left-handed spinners are not related by complex conjugation. So that means that we can, in principle, consider these two equations as completely independent. And this allows us to give A mu and V mu background values, which are not just real, but can actually be complex. Oops. In Lorentzian signature, this is no longer true because this equation is related to this by complex conjugation, and then A mu and V mu have to be real. But in Euclidean signature, it's not true, and actually this is the reason why, it's part of the reason that like there is a quite rich set of manifolds where supersymmetry can be preserved. Okay. One example of this procedure is like the reinterpretation of the work of Diptyman, Sen, and Rommersberger on putting n equal 1 supersymmetric theories with an R symmetry on S3 times S1. So one can take the Euclidean cylinder, S3 times R, and then we can give A and B like an equal background value, just like putting them constant along the axis of the cylinder. Also, like you give them actually an imaginary in Euclidean space, we have like an imaginary value, and with this choice of background fields, we can solve these equations and find actually two solutions for Z, two independent solutions for Z, and two independent solutions for Z bar. So the solutions have the following properties: so Z and Z bar are independent of tau. And both Z and Z bar transform so the isometric group of the cylinder is S2 left times S2 right times R, where R is the translation on the axis. And both the two solutions Z and the two solutions Z bar are doublets under S2 left, while they are singlets under S2 right. One important point is that we do not need the theory to be superconformal in order to put it on this on the cylinder. So this is different from like just doing the conformal mapping for a superconformal field theory. So the resulting superalgebra is S2 slash 1 left, which means that it contains the S2 left part of the isometry of the tree sphere, times S2R. This is just the same S2R as the isometry, times R, which is time translations. And because these spinners are tau independent, they do not depend on tau, we can actually compactify the cylinder and place the theory supersymmetrically on S3 times S1. Yes? Right, So given this equation, one can explore what solutions they allow in Euclidean signature and what solutions they allow in Lorentzian signature. So when the In some cases, it's possible to to define some sort of analytic continuation, and for some geometry, you can go from one to the other. But in general, that's not the case. It's certainly not the case when this A and B have like arbitrary complex values. So indeed, the classification is separate from the for the Lorentzian and the Euclidean case. Another trick that one can play in this scenario is that, like, if the theory has U1 flavor symmetries, then we could add background gauge fields along the axis of the cylinder. And actually, these background gauge fields can be generically complex also in the Euclidean case. And so the real part of mu f corresponds to like shifting, choosing a different R symmetry to couple the supergravity to. And like the imaginary part is just comes for the ride because we are in Euclidean space, so we can allow for complex background gauge fields. Okay, so a related set of theories are n equal to theories in three dimensions with a U1 R symmetry. So these are just comes from like dimensional reduction of the n equal 1 theories in 4D. So this is the superalgebra. And these theories also have something which is called the R multiplet, and was studied by Dumitrescu and Seiberg. It contains the energy momentum tensor, the R current, J mu R, the supercurrent. There is also a conserved current which corresponds to the central charge. And finally, there is a scalar operator J. And again, there is a version of supergravity, which we call new minimal supergravity in 3D, which has various auxiliary fields which couple to this operator. So there is a U1R connection, which couples to J mu R. Then there is a graviphoton C mu, or alternatively, like a conserved vector field V, which is just the star of this of the D of the graviphoton. And this couples to the conserved to this conserved current corresponding to the central charge. And finally, there is a scalar H, which couples to this scalar J in the supercurrent multiplet. An important point is that if the theory is superconformal, then these two operators, J mu Z and J, are redundant, and the multiplet can be shortened to a smaller one. And again, here, like all matter and Lagrangians can be worked out in the rigid limit. And we also have like some reduction of the Killing-Spinor equations to the three-dimensional case. So they are similar to the ones in four dimensions, except that now we have this scalar H appearing besides B and A. So these equations were analyzed in like a series of papers by Clara, Tomaselli, and Zaffaroni, and by Closet, Kumargoski, Dumitrescu, and I. And also, I want to point out that quite recently, these people have actually went through the trouble of giving a complete component formulation of n equal to new minimal supergravity in 3D. So like it's actually now possible to just take these component expressions and take the rigid limit to find the corresponding rigid theories. So the canonical example here is that of the round 3 sphere. So the round 3 sphere can be placed any two theory with a U1 R symmetry can be placed supersymmetrically on the round 3 sphere, preserving four supercharges by just setting this scalar background to these imaginary values minus I over R, and V and A are set to 0. So the resulting superalgebra is just S2/1 left times S2R. So actually, you can interpret this theory as just coming from dimensional reductions of the theory on the cylinder along the on S3 times S1 along the S1. So you get this theory. And an interesting point is that this theory on the three sphere is not reflection positive unless this operator H, which has this background field H, which has these funny imaginary values, decouples. So this happens whenever, like, H, oops, So remember that H couples to this J, so actually it will decouple whenever this J is a redundant operator. So for instance, if the theory is conformal, then this coupling disappears, and the resulting theory should be reflection positive. So this explains a problem that one could have, is that how is it possible to get a supersymmetric field theory on the tree sphere when the tree sphere is supposed to come from an analytic continuation of the Sitter space, and supposedly there is no supersymmetric field theory in the Sitter space. So the point is that there is no unitary supersymmetric field theory in the Sitter space, and therefore, indeed, if these theories that we constructed are not unitary, because they don't come from an analytic continuation of a unitary theory, because they are not reflection positive. So this is how we can get out of this no-go theorem for supersymmetry on the sphere. We can also interpret these complex background gauge fields along the S1 direction. So under dimensional reduction, these complex backgrounds will give rise to the following. So the imaginary part give rise to real masses in the n equal to theory in three dimensions. And the real part of these background fields corresponds again to shifts of the different choices, parametrization of different choices of the R symmetry whenever I have U1 flavor symmetries present in the problem. And the fact that they come from the same background field turned in four dimensions means that in the Lagrangian, this parameter T, which parametrizes the choice of R symmetry, and the real masses always appear in this combination T plus IMF. If it's known in general when the resulting theory is reflection positive? I don't think so. Also, for manifolds which are generic manifold, I would have problems in defining what is reflection positivity. So for the sphere, I can define what reflection positivity would be, but. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I. Yeah, there must be some. Yeah. So in this case, one could half the sphere. In general, yeah. Yes. That's true. Well, on the other end, on a generic manifold, this superconformal theory will be coupled to for instance, it could be coupled to a funny. On the sphere, yeah. So on the sphere, there is only H turned on, so that indeed, when you flow down, H should be coupled to some redundant operator, so you're left with just the superconformal coupling of the superconformal theory, yes. Okay. Any other question? Okay. So next, I will talk about trying to find out what are all the spaces on which this Killing-Spinor equations can be solved, starting with the case of new minimum supergravity in four dimensions, which is perhaps the simplest one. So what we are asking for are which Riemannian manifolds and which metrics are such that we can find some solution to these two equations. Obviously, we don't just need to specify the metric. We also need to specify the values of these background fields, A mu and V mu. So the results of this classification that I will talk more in the following, but I just give here a very brief review, is that it is possible to find one killing spin of Z, or alternatively one Z bar, whenever the manifold, if and only if the manifold M is complex and the metric G is Hermitian with respect to whatever complex structure we choose. If we want to have two solutions, two independent solutions, one Z and one Z bar, so different with different R charges, then this is possible only on manifolds which are a torus fibered over a certain Riemann surface sigma. And then there are also two cases which I'm not going to talk about. So it's like one can ask for two independent solutions Z, so with the same R charge. And this requires the manifold to have SU2 holonomy, at least in the compact case. And finally, if one wants four supercharges, then like the list of manifolds is like pretty restricted. There is only like R4 or like compactifications that offer, for instance, the four torus, S3 times R, which we already considered, and S3 times S1. Or also you can have the hyperbolic space times R. OK, so let me just spend some more words about the first two cases. So the case where we ask for just one single solution of a definite chirality, and the case where we ask for two solutions of opposite chirality. So here is the equation we have to try to find solutions of. So this equation is linear and homogeneous in Z. So one thing that we can say is that if there is a solution, this solution has to be zero, has to be non-zero everywhere on the manifold, because if it had a zero somewhere, then it would be zero everywhere. So non-trivial solutions are nowhere zero. And that means that we can consider the following tensor, which is just obtained by contracting Z and its complex conjugate with some sigma matrix in the middle. And notice that this is a good tensor. Z had R charge 1, but Z dagger like will have opposite R charge, so this has R charge 0. And also, it's well defined because Z does not have zeros anywhere, so I can divide by the absolute value of Z squared. And then it's just a question of playing with fields identities to show that the Jmu nu is an almost complex structure, that is, it squares to minus the identity. Jmu nu is compatible with the metric, which means that this is satisfied. Or if I go to local complex coordinates, the metric only have I bar components and no II or I bar component. And finally, I can compute derivatives of the covariant derivatives of the complex structure by using this equation. And what I find out is that these imply that this almost complex structure is actually a complex structure, so it's integrable. So that means that the manifold has to be complex. Actually, it has to be Hermitian because the metric is compatible with the complex structure. So this shows that it's necessary for the manifold to be complex in order to be able to solve this equation. It's actually possible to also go in the other direction and show that on any Hermitian manifold, if I take like one complex structure Jmu nu, I can find a solution Z such that this complex structure is given by this formula. And this was found both by us and by this group of people, Clare, Tomasiello, and Zaffaroni in Milan. So in order to give you an idea of why this is the case, I will start by considering the case where the manifold is scalar. Then for a scalar manifold, we can just set this auxiliary vector field V nu to 0. And then the killing spinor equation reduces to this. Now, it is on a scalar manifold, the holonomy of the Levi-Civita connection is special. It's contained in U1 left times S2R. So the reason why the U1 factor is in the left is because I'm assuming that the complex structure is obtained from a left-handed spinor. So if I were starting from like the right-handed spinor, then I could also define a complex structure, and then like the holonomy of the Levi-Civita connection would be in S2 left times U1R. But okay, it's just a matter of choice. And now, given this fact, I can use the U1 R symmetry to twist away the U1 left part of the Levi-Civita connection holonomy. And in this way, I can get a solution Z on the manifold. So this is some sort of twisting of like a theory on a Ketter manifold using the U1 R symmetry. Okay, so this is the case when the manifold is Ketter. But in general, we don't have a Ketter manifold, which means that the Levi-Civita connection is not compatible with the complex structure. That is, the covariant derivative of the complex structure is not zero. Also, the holonomy of the Levi-Civita connection will not be special, so we cannot use this trick. However, first of all, we can compute the covariant derivative of the complex structure, and we can find out that this vector field v mu has to be set to this value, which depends on the covariant derivative of the complex structure, plus a piece which is undetermined by the complex structure and the metric. So the background gauge, the background field v is not completely determined by the geometry. It also depends on a choice of a tree form, which is a 2,1 form. So it has two holomorphic indices and one anti-holomorphic one, which is closed. In general, like it's a general feature of the analysis of these equations that the background fields are not completely determined by the geometry, but there is some redundancy that one can tune, that one can choose at will. And now, instead of using the Levi-Civita connection, I can consider other connections which are compatible with the complex structure. So for instance, one of these is the Chern connection. And then, setting v mu to this value, I can rewrite the Killing-Spinor equation in the same form, except that now, instead of having the Levi-Civita connection here, I have the Chern connection. And a mu is shifted by some well-defined one form. And now, because the holonomy of the Chern connection is in U1 left and S2R, I can play the same trick as before, and I can use the U1 R symmetry to twist away the U1 left part of the holonomy of the Chern connection. And in this way, I get one scalar, one supercharge on the manifold. So basically, this is a very mild generalization of the twisting for the Ketter case. So the superalgebra, which is obtained in this way, is just one single supercharge, which is nilpotent. And one important point is that this spinor Z turns out to transform as a scalar under holomorphic coordinate changes followed by a certain by appropriate U1R transformations. So this is similar to what happens like for topological twisting, where like we are able to construct scalar supercharges, which are scalars under coordinate transformations followed by certain S2R transformations. In this case, we don't have S2, we only have U1, and therefore the coordinate changes that we can consider cannot be generic. They have to be changes of coordinates which are compatible with the complex structure. So these are changes of complex, holomorphic changes of the complex coordinates. Any question? Okay, again, if the theory in flat space has some global symmetry, say for instance it has some U1 symmetry, then it will have a conserved current which is part of a linear multiplet which contains, besides the conserved current, also scalar and fermions. And we can couple this this linear multiplet corresponding to the conserved current to background gauge fields. So these background gauge fields will be contained in some gauge multiplet, which contains a scalar D, a connection for the U1 symmetry, and also gauge genus. And in order for these background fields to be supersymmetric, we want to set the gauge genus to zero. And then it is possible to show that the variation of the gauge genus is so the variation of D and A is proportional to the gauge genus, so that will be zero. So in order to preserve supersymmetry, we have to check that the variation of the gauge genus is zero. And this gives rise to the following two equations. So first of all, the 0,2 part of the field strength of A has to be zero. And then D is given in terms of the field strength and the complex structure in this way. So this equation in particular implies that this background gauge field for the U1 flavor symmetry is a connection on a holomorphic line bundle on the manifold. So these are the conditions for having supersymmetric background gauge fields. And then I'll have like some theory which depends both on the background that I've chosen for the supergravity multiplet and on these backgrounds that I've chosen for the linear multiplet. Okay, so this exhausts what I wanted to say about the one supercharge case. So if we also require another supercharge with an opposite R charge, then there are further restrictions that we can place on the metric. So it still has, the manifold still has to be complex. Actually, it has to have also another complex structure, which comes from Z bar. But even more like importantly, we can define a vector by just contracting a Z and Z bar. Again, this is a good vector because it has R charge zero. And it's complex. It has a real and an imaginary part, which I call X and Y. And because Z and Z bar are both everywhere non-zero, X and Y also are everywhere non-zero. It actually turns out that they are orthonormal at every point. So X is orthogonal to Y, and they have the same norm at every point. Given X and Y and their complex conjugate, it's possible to write that, to write what the complex structure is in terms of this X, Y, and the metric. So the complex structure is determined by K. And then there are two cases that we can consider. There is either X and Y do not commute, in which case it's possible to show that the manifold has to be locally isometric to the round tree sphere times R. So this is not very interesting. The other case is that X and Y commute, and then this X and Y generate translation on some torus, which is fibered over some Riemann surface sigma. And you can also go backwards and show that whenever you have a torus fibered over Riemann surface sigma, then you can find two supercharges, one Z and one Z bar, with opposite R charge. In this case, the superalgebra is just, OK, so each one, each of the two supercharges squares to zero as before. But the anticommutator of the supercharge of positive R charge and the one of negative R charge give a translation along this complex Killing vector. And the translations along the complex Killing vectors commute with the supercharges. And once we have one of these metrics, we can dimensional reduce on some direction along the torus. And what we get is an n equal 2 field theory with a U1R symmetry placed supersymmetrically on some circle bundle over the Riemann surface sigma. And therefore, in this way, we have proven that it's always possible to preserve two supercharges for these theories. And indeed, all the squashed tree spheres which have been considered in the literature fall into this class. Okay. In 3D, also, we can try to find what are all the manifolds for which we can solve and find one solution to the Killing-Spinor equation, which in this case is this thing here. And again, we can just redo what we did in four dimensions. The solution has to be everywhere non-zero because the equation is linear and homogeneous in Z. Therefore, this allows us to define this vector eta mu, which also has to be everywhere non-zero. Actually, it turns out it has to have unit norm by using Firth's identities. And we can also define this tensor phi mu nu by just contracting eta with an epsilon. And it turns out that phi mu nu and eta satisfy this this equation. And these two equations together are what give what defines an almost contact metric structure on the manifold. But this is not all. Up to here, we just used Firth's identities on eta to prove these two facts. We also have like some differential constraints, which can be written in this way. So it's this tensor phi contracted with the lead derivative of phi along this vector eta must be zero. And this condition was like found in these two papers. And what is important is that we can reinterpret this condition by saying that the foliation generated by eta is what's called a transverse holomorphic foliation. So a different way to say this for like who doesn't know what this means is that this condition is very similar to the integrability condition for a complex structure. So in the case where we have an almost complex structure which is integrable in four dimensions, then this means that we can cover the manifold in coordinate patches where we can choose a complex coordinate adapted to the complex structure, and different patches are related by holomorphic coordinate transformations. So in the same way here, when this differential constraint is satisfied, we can choose special coordinates, which we call adapted, which are some sort of complex coordinates in three dimensions, where eta is just this vector field eta is just given by d tau. And then there is a complex coordinate z, such that this tensor phi only has a zz and a z bar component. And the metric like has a certain structure in these coordinates. But the important point is that two such coordinate charts are related by coordinate transformations for which the new z is a holomorphic function of the old z. So this is some sort of complex coordinates in 3D. And so like the manifolds for which this transverse holomorphic foliations can be defined have been studied, and there are some global obstructions in three dimensions. But this means that like a complete classification of the manifolds where we can preserve one supercharge in three dimensions is available. Okay, here, I don't know if I have, I'll probably skip. This is just, again, in three dimension, we can basically repeat what we did in four dimension and prove that whenever we have such a transverse holomorphic foliation, we can find one supercharge. And the idea, again, is to consider some connection which has special holonomy, and then using this the UNR gauge field to twist away part of this holonomy to find a supercharge on the manifold. And again, the supercharge will transform as a scalar under adapted coordinate transformations, so transformations of these adapted coordinates, followed by UNR transformations. Okay. Any question? So these results in 4D and 3D can be extended in different ways. So for instance, one thing that one can do is like forget about the minimal supergravity and go back to the old minimal supergravity, which couples to theories which have an FC multiplet. And again, classify all the manifolds on which it's possible to preserve supersymmetry. So I'm not going to say what the results are, but like one interesting point is that this allows to place a theory supersymmetrically on the four sphere. So in this case, the manifold does not need to be complex, and the four sphere is not complex. also, people have considered the Lorentzian case. So instead of considering Euclidean field theories, we can consider theories in Lorentzian signature. And then what happens is that the Killing spinor equation for Z and the Killing spinor equation for Z bar are related by complex conjugation, and which means that there always has to be a Killing vector. Actually, it has to be a null Killing vector, which is nowhere zero, because the spinor is nowhere zero on the manifold. And it actually turns out that this is not only a necessary condition, it's also sufficient. So like the necessary and sufficient condition to have like supersymmetric backgrounds for Lorentzian new minimum is that there is a non-zero null Killing vector in the geometry. And this can also be done in 3D. The only difference in 3D is that now the Killing vector does not need to be null. It can be either time-like or null. People also try to consider extended supersymmetry in four dimensions. But for now, the one paper that does this in some general way considered conformal theories with n equal to superconformal theories, which couple to n equal to superconformal supergravity. And So for these theories, it turns out that in the Lorentzian case, rigid supersymmetry requires the presence of a conformal killing vector. In the Euclidean signature, there is one case that these people consider, which is basically very similar to the Lorentzian case, where one needs a conformal killing vector, and then the supercharge squares to the translation along this conformal killing vector. But in the Euclidean case, one has to remember that there are other ways to preserve supersymmetry. So for instance, it is possible to perform a topological twist using the S2R symmetry. So these other possibilities were not really considered in this paper. And for some of these manifolds, the theory does not need to be conformal. So for instance, it is possible to preserve supersymmetry on a squashed version of the four sphere, which was analyzed by Ama and Osomichi, which has a U1 times U1 isometry. And this squashed four sphere is actually interesting because it is a geometry which cannot be obtained, which is not in the N equal 1 classification. So in order to put a supersymmetric field theory on this manifold, it needs to have extended supersymmetry. Okay, so also, like, people consider theories in different number of dimensions. So for instance, in 2D, there is a very nice story which has to do with field theories, supersymmetric field theories on round, n equal 2.2 field theories on round and squashed two spheres. So I'm not going to say much about this because I wouldn't do justice to these beautiful papers. But given the fact that the authors are here, perhaps they will. They can talk about this themselves. Also, people try to go to five dimensions, where, however, the situation is more complicated because we do not have a classification of the various possibilities for the supercurrent multiplets. And moreover, like, the equations that one gets are much more complicated. But there is some progress, and people have considered, like, specific manifolds. For instance, S4 times S1 was considered. S5 is very interested. One can see S5 as an off vibration of S1 over CP2. And then Osomichi, Song, and Terashima constructed theories with 8 supercharges on the round 5 spheres. And each supercharge squares to a translation along an op fiber. And they also interpreted these theories that they built as coming from coupling to background supergravity. So again, this idea of coupling to supergravity seems to be useful also in this case. And Imamura was actually able to squash these theories, deform the round sphere to a squashed version by just changing the radius of the S1 fiber over CP2. So this modifies the manifold, and the resulting geometry has only an SU3 times U1. And he was able to show that one can preserve a different amount of supersymmetry on these manifolds, either 2 supercharges or 6 supercharges. And in some cases, in the case with 2 supercharges, the supercharges square to a translation along the off fiber. In the other case, they don't. And actually, that's the most interesting one. And finally, Pan tried to start a classification program for n equal 1 supersymmetric geometries in 5D by relying on background supergravity. So the equations, as I was saying, are much more complicated. So this was not able to completely finish this program, but it's a start. And it allows to consider manifolds which are different from the 5 sphere or S4 times S1, for instance, S3 times S2, T3 times S2, T2 times S3, and so on. Also, I need to mention that in 5 dimensions, there is also another way of defining supersymmetric theories, n equal 1 supersymmetric theories, on any contact manifold with a certain choice of compatible metric. So this is some sort of twisted version of an n equal 1 theory, which was worked out by Shalin and Zabzin. And for the case of the round sphere, one can actually precisely show the connection between this and the theory constructed by Osomichi, Song, and Terashima, Amos. But in general, like the connection between this and background supergravity is not clear. But I think we will hear more about this perhaps the day after tomorrow. And finally, some people also consider like trying to classify supersymmetric backgrounds in six dimensions, starting from n equal 1 comma 0 supergravity. And again, one obtains necessary and sufficient conditions on the geometries, which are not very easy to interpret. Any question? So how much time do I have? Oh, okay, good. So, okay, so in the final 15 minutes, I'll try to address the last question, which is how do supersymmetric observables depend on the geometry of the manifolds? So here I'll like limit myself to in various ways. So first of all, I'll just consider the case of the partition function for n equal 1 theories with a UNR symmetry placed on some compact complex manifold. So this is the case where we have one supercharge with squares to 0. Also, I will consider the limit where the manifold is very, very large. And then it is possible to use methods like stemming from a linearized analysis around flat space. So this can be extended to a full nonlinear analysis, but I'm not gonna present this here. The results are the same. And finally, this is a caveat that like all what I'm gonna say is just classical. So like there is it is a question of like understanding like quantum issues. Okay, so so let's consider like a very large compact manifold and like some n equal 1 field theory in flat space. So in flat space, we can choose a single supercharge, which is parameterized by some spin or z. And this corresponds, as we said, to a choice of complex structure. Now, we can, given the fact that our theory is not on flat space, it actually corresponds to a small variation of the geometry. So there is a small variation of the metric, and there could be also a small variation of the complex structure. And also, given the fact that the background fields are not completely determined by the geometry, we could also have like this funny tree form appearing in the Lagrangian in various places. And all these variations couple, as I described, to the R multiplet of the theory. If I have in the theory some conserved current, then I can couple it to background gauge fields. And then the theory will also depend on the background values for the gauge multiplet, which couples to the linear multiplet where the current resides. So in total, I have like my variation of the Lagrangian, which depends on the variation of the metric, which couples to the energy momentum tensor of the theory. Then I can have like a small like variation of this vector background gauge field mu, which couples to the R current. There can be this background V, which couples to the string current. And finally, the background gauge fields can couple to the conserved flavor currents and to the scalar component of the linear multiplet. So the point is that if I consider this variation, some of these terms are going to be Q-exact, and therefore they will not contribute to the partition function of the theory. So what I have to understand is what are the Q-exact terms here. And in order to do this, I have to understand how the metric and the various auxiliary fields change once I change the complex structure or like other parameters. So one point which allows to go further like and extend this to the nonlinear level is the fact that this supercharge that I'm considering actually behaves like a scalar under complex coordinate changes followed by U1R transformations. And this allows to basically define some sort of twisted theory, which one can study at the nonlinear level with more ease. But we'll not talk about that. OK, so in order to make some progress, I have to remind you of some facts about deformations of complex structures in four dimensions. So let's suppose we have a complex structure on some manifold, and we deform it by changing it by a small amount. So then we can try to figure out what are the conditions at the linear level on this deformation, such that like the resulting tensor is again a complex structure. So if we use complex coordinates which are adapted to the original complex structure, we find out that this means that this deformation cannot have indices of the same kind. So the only deformations are those where the two indices are of different kinds. And this is just to like preserve the fact that the new complex structure has to square to minus the identity. Now, if we also impose that the new complex structure is integrable at the linear level, we get this equation. So basically, these deformations delta j ii bar have to be d bar closed. So this is at the nonlinear level. Then if I go to at the linear level, if I go at nonlinear level, there can be like further obstructions. But I just need the linearized analysis, so I can stop here. However, one important point is that not all the variations of the complex structure which satisfy these equations are actually different deformation of the complex structure, because some are just related by diffeomorphism. So an infinitesimal diffeomorphism parameterized by a vector field, a well-defined vector field epsilon on the entire manifold. And this diffeomorphism gives rise to like deformations delta j ii bar, which are d bar exact. So what I need to, like deformation of the complex structure corresponds to deformations delta j ii bar, which are d bar closed, modulo the ones which are d bar exact. So once I change the complex structure, I also have to change the metric in order for it to be still Hermitian with respect to the new complex structure. And this results in two different constraints. So the components of the matrix which are Hermitian, so they have like indices of opposite kinds, they are unconstrained. And this is obvious because I can always change them by keeping the metric Hermitian. But once I change the complex structure in the original, in the complex coordinates compatible with the original one, the metric gets like some components which have both holomorphic or both anti-holomorphic indices, and those are completely determined in terms of the variation of the complex structure. So in the same way, I can also consider what are the variations of the background gauge fields which are compatible with supersymmetry. And it turns out that these variations have to be d bar closed, modulo the ones which are d bar exact, which just come from like performing a gauge transformation. So given the fact that I now know how the metric changes and how when I change the complex structure, I can work out, given the formulas that I found for the various auxiliary fields in terms of the metric and the complex structure, how the various auxiliary fields have to change in order to keep the theory supersymmetric. And then I can put everything together. I can find how delta, what is the variation of the Lagrangian corresponding to this deformation. So in here, for simplicity, I'm just going to set this tree form which enters in the auxiliary field V to be exact so that it actually drops out. So what I get is that the variation of the Lagrangian is given by a bunch of Q exact terms, plus some terms which are not Q-exact. And the terms which are not Q-exact, however, only depend either on delta j ii bar or on delta ai bar. So these are the variations of the background gauge fields coupled to flavor symmetries. And these are the variations of the complex structure. So in particular, notice that there is no appearance of delta j I bar I. So it's the dependence on the variation is holomorphic. And the same can be said for the dependence on the variation of the background gauge fields. And one important point is that the variation of the Hermitian part of the metric does not appear except in the Q exact parts here. And therefore, the partition function cannot depend on the choice of Hermitian metric. So I can change the Hermitian metric of my manifold. This will imply some changes in the various background fields that I have to have in order to preserve supersymmetry, but like the partition function will not change under this variation. Also, like there is no like all the dependence on this exact tree form here is in the Q-exact terms. So like the dependence on this indetermination in the background field V is at most cohomological, so it doesn't. Okay, so this is like these are two interesting results. And now I can consider the dependence on delta j I bar and delta a bar. And one thing we have to remember is that our theory that we constructed was originally invariant under diffeomorphism and gauge transformations. So that means that whenever this delta j or delta a bar are trivial, so they either come from a diffeomorphism or a gauge transformation, it better be that I can rewrite these in such a way that they either are total derivatives or these variations are in Q-exact terms. And indeed, that is what happens. And that means that the partition function can only depend on the moduli of the complex structure, and it actually has to depend automorphically because only delta j I bar appears. And the same thing is true for the moduli corresponding to the holomorphic line bundles for the background cage fields. However, this is an important point, the partition function can have singularities, so it is not an holomorphic function, it can be a neuromorphic function. And this gives some hope that perhaps if we can understand the singularities, we can understand better what the partition function is. Okay, so the last 5 minutes, I'll just give an example. So this is our favorite manifold, S3 times S1. So S3 times S1 can be written as a complex manifold in a very simple way. So we can consider the two-dimensional complex space minus the origin. And then we can identify it in this way, so where P and Q are two complex numbers which satisfy these requirements. So the P and Q are actually the complex structure moduli, parameterize the complex structure moduli on one branch of the moduli space of complex structure on S3 times S1. Actually, this is like the biggest branch of this moduli space. And this is the one that we'll consider in the following. There are other branches, but they are more complicated. So on this branch, we have this complex structure, which are parameterized by P and Q. And it's actually possible to show that we can find Hermitian matrix for each choice of P and Q, which allow to preserve two supercharges. So those are matrix for which the manifold looks like TQ fibered over S2. And for the special case of P equal Q star, it follows from this analysis that we can actually preserve four supercharges. The point is that we can now consider the partition function on S3 times S1. And this is related to like a supersymmetric index, which is obtained by placing the theory on S3 times R, and then taking a trace over the Hilbert space of the theory on the S3. So this is the trace. There's a minus 1 to the fermion number. And then the various states are weighted with respect to their weights under rotations along the S2 left and S2 right of the isometry of the tree sphere. And their R charges are. And also, one can add some fugacity for flavor symmetries in the theory if there are such flavor symmetries. And it follows from like the analysis of this of what these parameters P and Q are, that these are nothing but the same P and Q in the previous slides. So indeed, the partition functions depends holomorphically on the moduli of the complex structures on S3 times S1. And this U can be identified with an holomorphic line bundle modulus for the flavor symmetry corresponding to this QF. And the index is indeed meromorphic in P and Q. And it does not depend on the choice of Hermitian metric. And this is why it can actually be computed in the UV, where, like, for instance, one can choose a theory which is free in the UV and then compute it over there, like by choosing the manifold to be very small. And the result should be the same. In the AR, where like the theory will flow to some interesting fixed point. And in this way, one can use this object to like check dualities and so on. There is a huge literature on computing these indices. So what we add to this literature is just that these indices have a natural interpretation as functions over the moduli space of complex structure on S3 times S1. Any questions? And there is a similar story in three dimensions, where instead, it turns out that the partition function only depends on the moduli corresponding to this transverse holomorphic vibration. And indeed, it can be shown that for manifolds which are diffeomorphic to S3, this moduli space is one complex dimensional, and this one complex dimensional parameter is indeed this parameter on which all these partition functions depend. Okay, to conclude, so there is this new tool we have to study the dynamics of strongly coupled supersymmetric field theories, which involves placing them on some curved manifolds preserving supersymmetry. And I've shown that there is a way to try to understand supersymmetric field theories in curved space in a general way by coupling them to background supergravity. And this allows to classify what are all the possible supersymmetric geometries given the kind of theory we are considering. So for instance, for a theory which has an R multiplet, we know that they can be put supersymmetrically on a complex manifold and so on. And there is still work to be done in order to complete this classification to other cases, extended supersymmetry or five dimensions and so on. And the other thing I've talked about is in certain cases, we can study what is the dependence of various supersymmetric observables on the geometry. And it turns out that they are almost topological in the sense that they do not depend on many of the features of the metric on the manifold. They only depend on a finite number of parameters, which in the case of complex manifolds, we have interpreted as the complex moduli, so the choice of complex structure. Yes, which one? I see. But okay, so the only point is, so if I get one of these theories, I could consider its short distance limit, and presumably it should correspond to some supercurrent being coupled to some kind of supergravity, I think. Perhaps that's not true, but I would imagine that there should be a way to get it also in this way of classifying it, so that perhaps it's a different way to get. So I don't know if there are different manifolds. Yeah, that's it. No, it's not true for a complex manifold. There are no isometries. When you have two supercharges of opposite chirality, then yes, indeed, one can. Basically, the anticommutator has to be a translation along some direction, so you get some killing spin, some killing vector. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So again, so there is the case where on the right hand side there is not the supercharge just squares to zero. So that's so then there is no Killing vector. So it is not obvious that just having like a Killing vector on the right hand side is enough. So for instance, in four dimensions for n equal one with a U1R symmetry, one actually needs two Killing vectors, which turn out to be orthogonal. So it seems so. It is not obvious to me that like just having a Killing vector in the geometry will be enough. In some cases it is, that's true, but yeah, right. Yeah. But at least for four-dimensional, well, unless there are other cases which do not fall into these classifications, which could perhaps be obtained in the way that in some other way, then like at least for four dimensions we have a complete classifications. For n equal one, field theories in four dimensions, and yeah, then the question is like if we can extend this to like other kind of theories, like for instance with extended supersymmetry or different number of dimensions. So things can get pretty complicated. Already in five dimensions, it's pretty complicated. I think there has been some work in yeah. So like what I was talking. No. Okay. So yeah, right. Yeah. So the constraint we get is the fact that where is it? Wow. Here we get this constraint, right? Yeah. But to be fair, I mean, in the examples that have actually been worked out, there is not a lot of, let's say that people did not explore like the most complicated. I don't know. I would imagine not. Let me think. Yeah, because somehow they. Yeah. Well, in this way of. Somehow you would want the. Yeah, you would somehow want this. Yeah, somehow one would want to have like this background fields A mu and D to, for instance, appear in the variation of the gravitino. But right, but yeah, this does not happen. But like, perhaps one can like integrate out partially some fields and then get it. But I don't think you will get more geometries in this way. Yeah, one can consider other. Well, we didn't actually classify all the possible supersymmetric pseudoposites. So that's one question that it would be nice to try to figure out in generality. But yeah, one can have like various like surface operators which are supersymmetric, and but for now we just consider the partition function. It's the simplest starting point. We also wanted to somehow understand why this different squash tree spheres always give rise to the same function. It seemed that there had to be like a good explanation for this fact. Well, they go right. So all what. So we didn't really do anything beyond like just looking at the classical level. What the variation of like what Q, what are the Q exact parts in the variation of the action? So that's, I mean, all sorts of like anomalies can change these results in ways which are not which we didn't study yet.